All right, let's get underway if we could, please. My name is Bill Shambrin. I'm director of the Hudson Institute's Bradley Center for Philanthropy and Civic Renewal. I'm pleased to welcome you to today's discussion entitled Taxmageddon, Renegotiating the Relationship Between Government and the Charitable Sector. Since this is a gathering of American foundations, it's almost mandatory that I get us underway by citing an ancient African proverb, not the one about the village and the children. You'll hear that at other foundation gatherings. There's another African proverb, and it goes like this. When bull elephants fight, the grass gets trampled. Now, the bull elephants of American politics will be gathering later this fall for a serious fight. As the headlines and cartoons that have been cycling as you walk in, as they suggest, we're about to be hit by a series of tax hikes that are truly monumental. Almost every tax cut enacted since 2001 is scheduled to expire at the end of this year. That means that taxes will rise by more than $500 billion in 2013, an average of some $3,500 per household. Almost 90% of Americans will see their taxes rise. At the same time, as a result of this year's Budget Control Act, a mandatory across-the-board series of spending cuts is scheduled to take effect in 2013, amounting to some $110 billion, split evenly between domestic and defense spending. So no wonder the bull elephants of our politics, very powerful interest groups representing the full gamut of interests with stakes in federal taxing and spending, are gathering in Washington now and sharpening their tusks. For the struggle to reshape our fiscal system in perhaps unprecedented ways is about to begin. In the coming clash of elephants, though, one sector seems to have been treated as little more than a hapless patch of grass beneath their feet. American civil society and the charitable tax deduction that does so much to nurture it are being trampled in the fight to secure maximum advantage in a future tax structure. President Obama has proposed no fewer than 7 times to reduce the charitable tax deduction, and several weeks ago it was reported that Governor Romney might be open to a recommendation for reducing the charitable tax deduction as part of his across-the-board tax cut program. These are only the most prominent examples of our political elephants, or our elephants and donkeys, using the charitable tax deduction as just a handy patch of grass for their quarrels. How bad do things look for the charitable tax deduction and for American civil society? And more important, what can you, gathered in this room today, do about it? Can the grass fight back? We have an expert panel today to help us tackle these questions. We'll hear first from someone familiar to you all, Sandra Sorsky, Executive Director of the Alliance for Charitable Reform, sponsor of this panel, and co-founder of Urban Sorsky & Associates, a government affairs firm in Washington, D.C., as a tax attorney, she has served in a variety of posts on the Senate side of the Hill. Next will be Alex Reed, who is of counsel in Morgan Lewis's tax practice, advising tax-exempt organizations of all sorts. Prior to Morgan Lewis, Alex served as counsel for the Joint Committee on Taxation, so he knows what people on the Hill are saying about us behind our backs. And finally, he'll tell us, I hope. Finally, we'll hear from Cleta Mitchell, partner in the Washington office of Foley & Lardner, a member of the board of the Lyndon Harry Bradley Foundation in Milwaukee, and a former member of the Oklahoma House of Representatives. She was recently named by National Journal as one of the 25 most influential women in Washington. Sandra, why don't you get us underway, please?
Thank you very much.
Sandra's going to be walking.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. And I want to welcome you all here to the first panel of ACR issues that we have over the next couple of days. So thank you for joining us. So as Bill mentioned, we've got a lot of trouble coming between now and the end of the year. And it's called the fiscal cliff. So between the fiscal cliff, Taxmageddon and sequestration. It's a wonder why folks in America look at Washington and sort of shrug their shoulders. Why? Because we make up words. So that we're on the same sort of playing field, I thought it'd be helpful to define what the fiscal cliff is, what Taxmageddon is, and what sequestration is. So first off, Taxmageddon. Taxmageddon refers to, as Bill noted, all of the tax increases that are going to happen on January 1st. I want to point your attention to that number, $455 billion. It's anywhere between $450 and $500 billion of tax increases that are going to take place on January 1st if Congress does nothing. Sequestration. What is sequestration? Well, it's about $1.2 trillion of budget cuts that are going to begin taking effect on January 1st. About half come from our defense program, and about the other half come from domestic programs and Medicare. So who thought this was a good idea? How did this happen? Right? How did we get here? Well, over the past couple of years, policymakers, president, members of Congress have tried to come up with ways to drive down the deficit. And they put together various commissions and super committees. And all of these efforts, these bipartisan efforts, have failed. They haven't been able to come up with a package of policies that give us a slope down to a reduced deficit. And instead, now what we have is what the backstop is, which is a cliff. This huge increase in taxes that occurs at the end of the year and the huge budget cuts. So lots of big numbers, but really, what do they mean? So we've got folks like Ben Bernanke, not exactly a Chicken Little, saying to us, you know what, if this happens, I am very worried that our fragile economy is going to go back into a recession. Tax Policy Center puts some numbers to it, and as Bill noted, that if Taxmageddon happens, if this fiscal cliff happens, American families are going to see about a $3,500 increase in their taxes. That is a substantial and meaningful amount to most Americans. The Congressional Budget Office, again, a bipartisan group, very comfortable with reporting why a recession happened 4 years ago. This is the very first time in its history the Congressional Budget Office is forecasting a recession. This is important. So, but there are a lot of other folks who think that we should just rip the Band-Aid off. A lot of other folks believe that deficit reduction is critical. If we don't get our deficit down, we are going to continue to lag with economic growth and GDP. So let's rip the Band-Aid off. Let's go over the cliff, all in the interest of driving down the deficit as quick as possible. So what are policymakers going to do? Well, policymakers are loath to let us go off the fiscal cliff and then go back to their constituents on January 2nd and say, well, your taxes are going up, the programs that some of you rely on are going away, and I'd like you to vote for me in 2 years. That's just not going to happen. And so policymakers are right now yearning to reach across the aisle and to work with the other side to come together on this slope. So it's not a cliff towards deficit reduction, but it's a slope to deficit reduction. Unfortunately, we've got an election in the way. No one's really right now in the mood to reach across the aisle and smile at the other party and say, let's make a deal. So this lame duck session after the election is really the last hope for policymakers to come together before this fiscal cliff happens and put into place policies that are going to be a slope to deficit reduction and not a cliff. So, if you were a policymaker, how would you do this? Well, in your own budgets, if you're tapped out on your credit cards, you've got no money in the bank, what do you do? Well, you look at where your big costs are, right? You're not going to choose all the penny ante stuff. You're not going to switch toilet paper brands from Charmin to the generic. No, you're going to sell your car. You're going to maybe move to a smaller home or rent, right? So Congress is telling us in this slide that of all of the big costs in taxes, the biggest are the employer health insurance. Number 9 is the charitable deduction. Congress is telling us that we are among the top 10 biggest costs in the tax code. So we're a number to them. So when they, as Bill said, go hunting around for how to cut and slash and get to that slope, they're going to be looking at us. And they are looking at us. So just to give you a sense of other numbers that Congress is looking sharply at, in this slide, Congress tells us that the folks who use the charitable deduction are those making over $100,000. Specifically, those making over $200,000. Not exactly a sympathetic group, right? No one likes wealthy people. And when you look at which types of organizations, which charities rely the most on private giving, it's environment and animals, international, and what one member told me, it's the SOBs, the symphony, the opera, and the ballet, right? Arts and culture. And we can all laugh, but really it's sad. So is this one party? Is it one area? Who's really pushing back? Well, it's coming from all corners. It's coming from the right. It's coming from the left. It's coming from presidential candidates. It's coming from the press. It's coming from the Congressional Budget Office, the bean counters. It's coming from bipartisan presidential commissions. Everyone has an idea on how we can cut, cap, limit the charitable deduction, which happens to be the 9th biggest cost in the Internal Revenue Code. Let's look at Governor Romney's proposal. Because we've beaten up Obama enough, let's go to Governor Romney. And because this is very timely. So a couple of days ago, Governor Romney was interviewed by a Denver newspaper in which he said that one of his ideas for tax reform to try to drive down to this slope is to put a cap on the charitable deduction, $17,000. And I expect over the next couple of weeks that number is going to go up, it's going to come down, but let's, for argument's sake, let's take $17,000. It may seem like a lot of money, right? Well, not really, because if you look at the average taxpayer who itemizes in the U.S., the average taxpayer takes about $20,000 in itemized deductions. Over $10,000 of that amount is the home mortgage interest deduction. Not really a variable. $3,500 or so is state and local income taxes. Not at all variable. And $3,200 is for real estate taxes. Again, not a variable amount. When you total those numbers up, that's over $17,000. And you've hit the cap, and there's no room left for the charitable deduction. So it is very meaningful that cap. So here are a couple of reasons posited by folks who want to change the charitable deduction. First, it favors the wealthy. It really is only applies to folks who itemize. And most people take a standard deduction. They don't itemize. Second, this is the glass half full, folks. People are going to give anyway. They don't need an incentive. And the third is it costs the government too much. It should be more targeted. And what they're saying there is we, Congress, are going to pick the winners and losers. Well, beware of policymakers picking winners and losers in the charitable community. Here's how we defend the charitable deduction. 3 arguments. Number 1, the first argument is this is about the beneficiaries. Those are the biggest losers. People who rely on these services and on these charities are the biggest losers. Number 2, this is a unique benefit. It's a unique private giving incentive, unlike every other deduction and credit in the code that encourages you to buy smart vehicles, buy Energy Star appliances, buy a bigger home. This private giving incentive encourages you to give away your income, give away. You don't benefit. And then the third, and my colleague Alex Reed is going to get into a lot more detail and do a lot better job than I am, the third argument, which we are developing, it's an often overlooked, forgotten argument, is that money that you give away, it's not part of your income. It never has been part of your income because you've given it away. And therefore, the IRS, the government, shouldn't be able to capture it and then give it back to you in a deduction, because it's never theirs to begin with. When we ask the American public what they think about the charitable deduction, the private giving incentives, charities generally, here's what they tell us. An overwhelming number say they want a full private giving incentive, that they care about what happens to charities and they don't want to diminish or provide a disincentive for private giving. So what can you all do about it? Well, come to Washington. We have a number of events coming up this year and next year where we need you to come to Washington and talk about how private giving is impacting your communities, quite simply. And the bottom bullet are a couple of factors that we found most resonate with lawmakers. What is the number of employees in the organizations? How much do these organizations rely on private giving? How many beneficiaries do you all serve? And with that, I'm going to pass the mic over to my colleague, Alex Reed, and he's going to go into a lot more detail on that third argument I spoke about.
So, Alex, what's the story here? It is, after all, a deduction that's given to us by the federal government. Why shouldn't we just throw that deduction into the pot along with these other reductions? And, I mean, is there something about this, you know, civil society that's special that we need to pay attention
right.
to?
Right. That's what I'm going to talk about right now. And you're right that it's viewed as just another tax expenditure. Right, so I'm going to talk about three things. I'm going to talk about the purpose of the deduction, how it's come to be misunderstood of late, and the risk that creates for American democracy. That's why we have Lady Liberty up there to remind us all of what we're about. All right, so there's Teddy Roosevelt. He's killed a buffalo. The charitable deduction is big game. This is an analogy that Grover Norquist threw out. I was talking to him the other day, and he said, you know, tax expenditures are big game. Sandra kind of referenced this, the top nine, the big five big game, or the elephant, the rhino, the buffalo, the lion, the leopard. He said, which one is the charitable deduction? Well, it's number nine. It's big game. The question is it fair game, right? So you've heard about Tax-mageddon, you've heard about the fact that we're tightening our belts, and the question is, where does the charitable deduction fit into all of that? How have we gotten lumped in with the rest of the carnage? Charitable giving is natural, right? That's a one-room schoolhouse. This is this idea that charity, what is charity? Charity precedes government. Charity is what we do before there is a government. You're on the frontier. You need to educate. Your community has children that need to be educated. You build a school. You gather together. You build a school. You have a vision of what the public good is, what your community needs. Charity is the way that you accomplish that directly without a government. You don't, if there isn't one, this is how you take care of your needs. It's about self-reliance. It's about stubbornness, right? If you're part of institutions and you don't like the way they're going, well, by gosh, you can form your own. Every one of us could go out. We could start a charitable organization tomorrow. We could start a church tomorrow. Every single one of us. This is what the charitable deduction and the tax-exempt status of charitable organization is about. It's enabling each of us to realize our individual visions of the public good, whatever those may be. All right. This is important. This is deep in American culture. It's what we're about. It's what Alexis de Tocqueville, the French political scientist, observed about America in the 1830s. He came here. He said, you know, democracy is a great thing. We want it in Europe. What is the special sauce in America? Why is there a democracy so interesting to us? What is it about it? Well, he realized that democracy itself flows from this self-reliance. it flows from the idea of people taking care of their needs first, taking care of their vision of the good, and that effect of defining that individual act of defining the public good as you see it leads to democratic principles. All right. So that's King George III. All right. Before the Revolution, we had a sovereign who owned everything. That's the deal. The sovereign owns all property, makes all law, and the relationship of citizen, you're not really a citizen, but the relationship of the subject to the sovereign is one of supplicant, and you ask permission to the sovereign to do anything. That's how charity worked back then as well. You made a petition to the king, I would like to create an institution. The king said yes or no, and that's how it worked. This is at odds with the concept of self-reliance. It's not, there's a rivalry between the sovereign and each of us defining the public good in our own vision, right? And it leads inevitably to revolution. The first thing listed on the Declaration of Independence, what really annoyed Americans was this guy. You know, we had all these great ideas about how to take care of ourselves, and he refused to let us do it. That was very annoying. So we had a revolution, and we overthrew the king, and we formed a democracy. All right. So not 30, 40 years pass, then when we run into this crisis, this question. That's Daniel Webster, and what he's doing is arguing the case of Dartmouth College, right? So Federalists founded Dartmouth College in 1754 through a gift, a philanthropic gift. They wanted to educate the citizens of New Hampshire and the Native Americans, which people weren't doing at the time. So the question, in 1812, the Jeffersonians swept, they took the governorship, they took the legislature in New Hampshire, and the Jeffersonians said, look, we're in charge now. Why are these Federalists in charge of this educational institution? We're a democracy. Wasn't this gift in 1754 a gift to the people of New Hampshire? We're the representatives of the people in New Hampshire. Wasn't that a gift to us? And don't we have the right to control that gift? It's a big question. This is a question of, is civil society separate and apart from the government or not? So that's Daniel Webster, and this is probably the only time ever that someone has made a speech so compelling in the Supreme Court that everyone actually wept. The Justice Marshall wept their accounts at the time. This was this patriotic argument that, you know, people who had just fought and died in the Revolution, they had this in their minds, and they realized, no, it's not a gift to the government. It's not a gift to the government. The government does not have the right to control Dartmouth College and replace the trustees, and it's an institution that is for the public good, as the founder envisioned it. So this is a big deal. This decision severed, in some ways, the control relationship between the government and civil society. It allowed them to operate when they agree and want to do a public-private partnership, that's fine, but they don't have to, and the government doesn't control civil society in America. All right. Okay, so this is all. Let me explain this analogy. What happens 100 years later? You impose an income tax. All right, they found that excise taxes weren't enough to support the government. It was hard to get enough kind of steady revenue. As soon as you put an excise tax on something, people stop doing that thing. So they said, forget it. We're going to impose an income tax. It was fought very hard. It had required a constitutional amendment. The 16th Amendment says that the government shall be able to lay a tax on all income from whatever source derived. So basically what happened there was the federal government appropriated the income tax base. It appropriated all income from whatever source generated in America, actually worldwide, by Americans. That's a big deal. Originally it was at low rates, but come 1916, We're preparing for World War I. There are sporadic German agents attacking things in the United States. Mexico is making an agreement with Germany to take the Southwest back. It's a troubling time. It's a crisis in American government. So they decide to radically increase the tax rates. They impose a 60% tax, 60% income tax on incomes above $2 million, which I guess if you index for that for inflation, that's on incomes above $35 million. So it's interesting. It's very, very different time. But the point being, that's when the charitable deduction came in. The government subsumed the tax base, and the charitable deduction was there to carve back from this appropriation by the federal government civil society. All right, the image here on the screen. This is a chairlift. This is just an analogy of the tax system. Income is equal to consumption plus saving, right? The income tax, the purpose of it is to say we're going to tax ability to pay. We're going to differentiate taxpayers by their ability to pay, and those with more ability, we're going to charge more than those with less. So we could tax you on consumption and saving, or we could tax you on income. They're equal. If we were to analogize that to skiing, ability to pay is like skiing. It's hard to tax skiing, but it's easy to tax rides on the chairlift. So that's what the income tax does. We tax you when you receive your income because we assume you're going to ski after you ride the chairlift. Right? Okay. So what is the charitable contribution? Right? What is the charitable contribution in this analogy? You ride the chairlift, but you do not ski, right? You ride the chairlift for some other purpose, like you ride the chairlift to help someone at the top who has been injured, and you're delivering a medical kit. That's just an example, right? You're not skiing. You don't consume the money that you give to charity. You don't save the money that you give to charity, right? So in that way, a charitable gift is very different from a spending or a consuming act. And that's the reason why it's different and why it ought not be considered part of the tax base, or whether that's an issue that is debated. Okay. So here's the question. If you include charitable gifts in the tax base, then the charitable deduction is the government giving a subsidy. It's making a matching contribution to those entities that you choose to support, right? If it's making a subsidy, it's a gift from the government, right? It's partly from you, and it's partly from the government. They're making a matching contribution. If it's a gift from the government, if it's a subsidy, then the government has the power of the purse. It has, or ought to have, some control over that which it is subsidizing. That's the argument. And that's the premise behind a lot of efforts to reform the charitable deduction. It's this dispute about is a charitable gift a subsidy, or is it an exclusion from the tax base? What I'm arguing is that it ought to be considered an exclusion from the tax base because you're not skiing. They're saying is it should be in the tax base because it's equivalent to skiing. All right. If you view the charitable deduction as an exclusion from the tax base, you see that its purpose is to create a boundary between the government and civil society. If the federal government is subsidizing charity, this is a picture of the Maginot Line. It's a little bit ironic, right? This is the boundary that impenetrable boundary that France erected against Germany prior to World War II, which Germany promptly went around through Belgium, and France fell very quickly. But anyway, the idea is that there is this boundary that's erected between the government and civil society. just as the Dartmouth College decision kept civil society out of government control, the charitable deduction keeps civil society out of government control. It enables us to implement our vision of the public good, and altering the charitable deduction renegotiates this fundamental relationship between the government and civil society. So this, it's not a luxury we can do without. The debate right now in Washington about tax reform is that the charitable deduction is just one of many tax expenditures that's expensive, and you know we can't afford it, so we can get rid of it. It's that view is premised on the subsidy theory, which is essentially a merger of civil society with the government. That premise has lots of constitutional problems, because if the federal government is subsidizing churches, you run smack into the religion clauses of the Constitution, right? How can the federal government be making a matching contribution to your church? Doesn't that violate the Establishment Clause? I think it probably does, and the Supreme Court has said that it does. So this candle references Daniel Webster's passionate plea to the Supreme Court. He said, "Shall our government be allowed to take that which is not its own, to turn it from its original use and apply it to such ends or purposes as they in their discretion shall see fit? Sir, you may destroy this little institution, Dartmouth College. It is weak. It is in your hands. You may put it out, but if you do, you must carry on with your work. You must extinguish one after another all those great lights of science," that's extinguishing the candle up there, "which for more than a century have thrown their radiance across the land. It is, sir, as I have said, a small college, and yet there are those who love it."
Thanks, Alex. I expect there's another African proverb embedded in your presentation. Water buffalo should make themselves scarce when TR shows up.
Yes.
Yeah. Cleta, what on earth can we do? I mean, this is pretty scary stuff.
It is. And I'm going to give you sort of a practical kind of way to think about some of this and maybe some suggestions. This is the King George philosophy. Some of you may have seen this, the IRS 1040 easy do tax form. How much money did you make? Send it to us. Now, this is a philosophy, frankly, that we laugh, but actually that's basically what these policy thinkers are doing. When you see the charts and they're thinking about everything, this is really what they're saying. I have a different view. I hope that some of you share my view. It's our money, not theirs. And you'll notice theirs is the IRS. It is not theirs. So I think what we have to think about is whose money is it? And not only whose money is it, but also policymakers ought to be looking at, and they don't. This is very difficult in Washington because everything is codified. And I'm going to go through just a case study. Now, I don't want you to nitpick at me because these are different years and apples and oranges. I concede that. This is an analogy, people. But it is thinking about how government should do things differently, because one of our problems when we're talking about the fiscal cliff, when we're talking about all of these things, is that it presumes that government's going to keep doing everything it's been doing increasingly over the last 80, 90 years. So let's start with something that people in this room, and I know that the roundtable at these meetings every year always has programs about K-12, and many of your foundations give money to try to help deal with problems of education. This is an analogy. I want you to kind of just think about this. In August of 2011, Harvard University's Department, College of Education and Kennedy School of Government produced a study that compared American eighth graders in math and reading to their peers throughout the world. 65 countries, these are the countries that participated. And they measured proficiency in math and reading of eighth graders throughout the world. Among those that participated in this study, the countries, the U.S. students had a 32% proficiency rate in math and came in 32nd in the world. And in reading, had a 31% proficiency rate, and they came in 17th out of 65 countries. And then they said, well, you know, some people say because we educate so many more kinds and nationalities and ethnic groups, so let's break it down by ethnic group in the U.S. And so they did that, and we find that still among white students that 42%, less than half, were proficient in either math or reading. And they said that that would put the white students, if you just took the white students, that they would be, they were surpassed by their peers in 16 other countries in reading and in, I mean, in math, and 40% that we were ninth in the world in reading. So this is really disturbing, right? We've heard The Nation at Risk by Bill Bennett, and, you know, the former president of MIT says we face many challenges. We're about to be hit by the full force of global competition. Terrible. Vinton Cerf, internet entrepreneur. America simply is not producing enough of our own innovators, and the cause is twofold, a deteriorating K through 12 education system. And then we have President Obama saying, we know what it takes to compete for the jobs and industries of our time. Yes, actually, we do know what it takes, but we're not doing it. Now, why are we not doing it? I contend part of the problem is government. Government is the problem in education. And we try to work around it, but it is a problem. It's the problem. Now come look at higher education. You compare the academic rankings of world universities. Look on that list. There are only two other countries on the list of the top 15. I went down to 15 because my husband and I spent a bucket of money at the University of Pennsylvania. And I, by God, was glad to see it on that list. And I was going to make it fit on this page no matter what. If you look at the percentage distribution of the top universities in the world, by country. In the top 100, the United States has over half, over a third of the top 500. Now, why am I showing you this? Look at the students enrolled in K-12 this fall, how the distribution of students. Now, actually, it's very interesting because the Department of the U.S. Department of Education doesn't have good statistics on homeschooled kids, and so these are estimates. I love that part. And look at the revenues for public elementary and secondary schools. It's almost all government. They include in the local proportion about 2.1% that includes probably all the funding and efforts that many of you are engaged in. But most of the money comes from government. Most of the kids are in the public schools. Now, look at higher education. This fall, four-year undergraduate institutions, look at the distribution. It's 59% public, but 41% private. And think about higher education. There are all kinds of schools. There are four-year state schools. There are private schools. There are, you know, girls' schools. Not many left, but, you know, but there are Catholic schools. There are it is the Dartmouth example that from winning that case, what we now have in higher education, renowned throughout the world. And look at higher education revenues. These are compared for 1980 and 81 to 2000, the chart on the right. Look at the drop in the state government percentage of higher education support. And these are public. This is for public degree-granting institutions. The federal government has a very small percentage. I think the chart on the right is probably misleading because I think that federal percentage doesn't include grants and contracts, which is included all in the other one for federal. The point is they have to be student fees, pay a big portion of it, but other services and activities that the colleges and universities have to engage in order to survive. And the tuition follows the students. The money follows the students in higher education. This is from the Princeton Review on financial aid. How much school costs minus how much you can afford equals how much you need. And student aid follows the students. Now, I give you that example between K-12 and higher education for a reason. It tells us we cannot continue to think that government must do all the things that it has always done. And Big Bird is a start, but it isn't the whole solution. And so here's the box, and we need to think outside the box about this whole charitable deduction issue, because Alex makes a very important point. It isn't just another thing like buying the right dishwasher so I can get $500 off my taxes. It's different from that. It is important. If you compare, the reason I want to do the comparison between K-12 and higher education is because higher education has much more innovation, much more entrepreneurial spirit, because they've had to, and much more choice, opportunity. And so we have to not just accept the parameters that we can't just be put in this box and say we're going to fight like crazy to protect the charitable deduction, because guess what? We will lose that fight. We will lose that fight. So we have to think outside the box about this differently. So I have an idea. Now let me say this. Well, here's one of my mantras. A whole lot of ideas is not a plan. So this is an idea. This is not a plan. But maybe we should just stop talking about this as a charitable deduction, because maybe we should have 100%. If you give money to charity, then that comes off, that's not defined as income. That would be very different than the way it is treated now. But maybe what we need to do is stop calling it the charitable deduction. Maybe we call it the charitable incentive. Maybe we call it something else. I mean, hire one of those people, Frank Luntz or somebody, to figure out, you know, he can do one of those focus groups on Hannity. And but the more you give away, the less income you have, and you're taxed on the amount that you haven't given away. I mean, but I just think that we have to be very creative, and we have to say, this is different. Government can't keep taking all of our money. It's our money, not theirs. And believe it or not, I think that that's a big fight. I think that's a philosophical fight among policymakers, because I think that they think they're King George, and they think that it is their money. They don't think it's our money. You didn't build that, so why would it be your money? And so I think it's very important that we think outside the box, and we understand that where government controls it, we see the results. Where government isn't solely in control, we have a better outcome. And I know that that is anathema to many, many of the great, brilliant thinkers like Nancy Pelosi and others in Washington, but Harry Reid, gosh, they probably went to public schools. But but I did. I went to public schools. But the point is, we have to think outside the box. We have to be creative. And that's what, this is an idea. It's not a plan. But by golly, we need a plan.
Great. Thank you.
Certainly no one has done more, I'm slightly biased, but certainly no one has done more than the Lyndon Harry Bradley
Absolutely.
Foundation to promote K-12 reform through the private sector. So this is a bold idea. It is, in fact, a great idea, we're told, by this label. What do you think about it, Alex and Sandra? What, any reactions? Or, and expanding on that a bit, if not this, what can we do? I mean, you all have presented a pretty depressing picture, right? I mean, this is across the board. This is not just the usual suspects who are after our money. It's some of our friends who seem to be after the charitable tax, the tax deduction. And maybe we should change the name, I don't know, to something else. And
right.
Any thoughts about that?
Well, one thought about that would be to call it an immunity, the charitable immunity, which is an analogy to the doctrine of intergovernmental tax immunity, which comes from the Supremacy Clause in the Constitution that says that the the laws of the federal government enacts have to be respected by the states. It's a concept of federalism. So the states aren't allowed to tax the federal government. The federal government's not allowed to tax the states. And the reason for that is if you could do that, the government would come to a grinding halt, right? You have to have these co-equal sovereign powers interacting in the same place. Calling it a charitable immunity would give the same respect to the people, right? When the people engage directly in activities that further the public good. So I like the idea. Amending the Constitution is always a tricky business, and it's
it doesn't happen often.
It does not happen often. From what I saw on the Hill, it's not a time of consensus in the country. And it takes a lot of consensus to get a constitutional amendment. But what I like about the idea is that it says what we're doing. It says what charity is, and it shows how it's different. That is something that, when you read the academic literature about the charitable deduction and tax-exempt status and 501c3, it's a jump ball. They say, here are 10, 15 reasons that it could be, looking at it, but no one says what it is and why it's there. That's what I was trying to explain. I think you can say why it's there. It's not just some strange tax statute. We don't know what it's doing there. It serves a very important purpose. So I like the idea of getting back to very basic principles.
So just to add to that, when we in Washington think about how to get something done, there are a couple of levers, right? There's the substance lever. You have to have the right arguments, and they have to be directed at the right people. And then you have to have the political. You have to be able to wrap your hands around someone's throat and squeeze till they squeal, right? and so you have to have both. And I think that this idea goes to the substance, that we have to remind policymakers, and we are, that there is a really good reason that charitable giving was part of our tax code. Because from the beginning, it was meant to be excluded. It's not meant to be part of the government's take. And the second part of it is the political. And I see my friend in the audience, Gloria Johnson Cusack, who is with Leadership 18, representing the largest human service organizations, the CEOs of the largest human services organizations in the United States. And together with Leadership 18 and with our friends at the Council on Foundations and others, we are squeezing until they squeal. We are bringing people to town to where they are and squeezing till they squeal, making the case, having members of Congress look into their faces and say, you know what? We are going to hit you. We are going to cut you. It's very different. It's very difficult for members of Congress and their staff to look into the eyes of folks who work in the charitable sector and say, yeah, it is you. You're the problem, and we need to get rid of people like you. It's very difficult to do that. And so we're hitting them on their home turf. So it is a substance, and it is absolutely the political.
Good. Great.
You know, one thing I would say, too, that never underestimate the importance of dealing with members of Congress in at home. And, it's harder and harder to get into the Capitol and see people. I mean, you have to have a photo ID to get into the Capitol, which I reminded the senators about when I testified on photo IDs before a Senate committee. I said, you know, Senator, I can't come see you without a photo ID. He was quite perplexed. But it isn't easy to see members of Congress, and you usually don't see them, but you can see them at home. And I think that it's really important that we come up with a plan that does have ideas in it that are bold, and then we set about to make them look you in the eye. Because if they look you in the eye, I think that we can make certain that this does not happen. They only get away with it if they're dealing with what Ross Perot called the Gucci loafer lobbyists. Because at one time, the tax code, and I haven't looked at it in a couple of years, but that lobbying on the tax code was the number one subject matter for lobbying. when lobbyists have to file their reports, they have to check the issues and disclose the issues on which they lobbied. And for many, many years, it was primarily the tax code. I don't know that that's true at the moment, but so I think that seeing people at home coming up with a plan and being willing to mobilize people all over the country is really important.
Yeah, we do actually have an example not too long ago when the proposal was floated that we would raise payout requirement from 5% to 6%. There was really quite an extraordinary mobilization of foundations, and as Cleta suggested, it wasn't the big foundations that carried the day. It was the folks back home who caught the congressman when he was back in his district and said, why are you trying to put us out of business? You know, we're talking about the museum down the street. It has a particular impact when it's something back home in the district.
Well, that's it for our time. Let's give our panelists a round of applause.